Welcome to the Tuesday, December 10th, 2019 regular closed session meeting of the East Bay Mud Board of Directors. Secretary Coleman, you do the roll, please.
Yes. Directors Coleman.
Present.
Katz.
Present.
Lenny.
Here.
McIntosh.
Here.
Mellon.
Present.
Patterson.
Present.
President Young.
I'm here. Is there anyone here for public comment? No? Okay. That's we will now convene to conference room 8 to discuss closed session agenda item 1A. Item 1B has been pulled from the agenda, and we will return here for our regular meeting at 1:15. Thank you. Ooh. Okay, welcome to the Tuesday, December 10th regular business meeting of the East Bay Mud Board of Directors, our last meeting of this decade, and our last meeting in 2019. Director Katz is participating from Spain, where he's attending the climate conference. The planning and also the legislative human resources committees met earlier today and will report out briefly under item 16. Can we have roll call, please?
Directors Coleman?
Present.
Katz?
See, this didn't work.
Present.
Great. Director Lenny?
Here.
McIntosh? Director McIntosh?
Yes.
Mellon?
Present.
Patterson?
Present.
President Young.
I am here. Okay, let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Okay. We have one presentation today that I believe Frank is going to give, but Alex?
I'll start this off. We're going to cover quite a bit here. So this is an opportunity to recognize the district's receipt of an award from the American Public Works Association, their Rodeo Award, spelled R-O-A-D-E-O, because it's on the road. Each year, the Public Works Association conducts a backhoe rodeo competition for heavy equipment operators to safely demonstrate their skills on a time course. There were 55 participants from local municipalities who competed in this year's event, and for the first time, the district entered the regional competition. And before we get down to acknowledgments, what we wanted to do was show a little video that gives you a sense of what's involved. What you'll see is that the operator has to grab and move into the garbage can one of these cones. Without knocking anything over. This is not a video game, this is real life.
Nice.
So we had a number.
Take you guys to the arcade.
A number of participants. So district participants included heavy equipment operators Christopher Gaines, Michael Maddox, Chris Plowman, and Kevin Skinner. And when I call your names, will you guys come up and then we're going to take a photograph? And the team also included Jimmy Rangel, who's assistant construction and maintenance superintendent. He was the coach. We had team captains, Laura Johnson, manager of pipeline construction and equipment, and also construction and maintenance superintendents Mobile Cox, Tim Harris, hi Tim, and John Hayden. So we'd like to ask that Director Mellon provide the award. First place, and this is only by a hair here, Christopher Gaines received first place, and Kevin Skinner was 1 second behind. So a very, very solid showing by our individuals and the whole team. So congratulations to the team.
for a little while when I was with the concrete company. But I have a vivid memory once of one of these backhoe operators, not necessarily here, working on a project when he realized that he snagged a gas line. And the result was that things got pretty exciting. But what made it so amazing is you're not bringing that backhoe just as cool as that and realize, oops. And so nobody got hurt. The building got demolished. But nobody got hurt because a backhoe operator knew exactly what he was doing. And this is a tribute to all of you, and I want to say how incredibly proud I am of each and every one of you. It's a privilege to be associated with you, really and truly.
Cool.
Well, better than the WWE.
You want me to?
Oh, we're right between the big guys.
One more.
I'll take 2, 8 and a half right
now. I'm impressed. I don't know if I can walk that trail. With
it's very, very difficult to operate it.
Okay. We have a number of speakers in public comment on a few items. Start with Yvette Rivera. You have 3 minutes.
And no report of closed session.
Oh, I'm sorry. Nothing to report from closed session.
Hi, thank you. I think everyone has a copy of this document that I have in my hand. I hope so. I provided one for each board member. Can you pass that out, please? I'll wait to speak until everybody has a copy of it.
Director Katz is on the phone, so he does not have a copy.
Oops, two-pager.
Okay, thank you. Restart.
Thanks. Thank you. I was in federal court on Friday, Ninth Circuit, in San Francisco. What I'm providing the district is a copy of the link for the United States Court of Appeals, a Ninth Circuit case that was held on Friday. It's actually, I'm sure you guys know, I didn't see it on the agenda today, that's why I'm here. But it is available if you haven't been filled in already. On YouTube under case number 17-16891, Yvette Rivera versus East Bay Mud et al., which includes ASME 444. Below on the left-hand side is a screen print of the U.S. court proceeding link. It's right above in blue if you need to take a look at it. I'm eventually going to try to transcribe everything that happened in that proceeding. On the right-hand side is my personal YouTube link. I'm going to be making a copy of the court proceeding just in case the court, you know, deletes their videos after a certain amount of time. So that's the first page. The second page is a court filing that just happened, I think, today. And it references a court case that just was decided on Friday. And it's from New York. It's Lenzi versus Systematic, Inc. And it has, well, I'm not even going to say what it has. I'm just going to say that this is a public document that was just entered into court proceedings. And I'm entering it into East Bay Mud's public documents, if anybody wants to see it, or if anybody wants to go to my court case on YouTube. It could be found under Yvette Rivera EB Mud. It's pretty easy to find. I only have 50 views at this point, but I'm sure it'll climb. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, next up, Justin Young.
Good Good afternoon. How are you guys doing today? My name is Justin Young. I am elected the first VP of Local 29. I am an associate electrical engineer, and I've been here at the district for 16 years. I'm here in front of you for assistance because an equity adjustment is needed for associate electrical engineers. Unfortunately, I'm in front of you to hear because the district failed again, and we have lost, voluntarily lost, another electrical engineer. On November 15th, the design division lost an assistant engineer. Management's approach of grow our own is failing if we can't even maintain an assistant electrical engineer for 2 years. I also recommend everybody looking at our job postings. We can't recruit. We have assistant electrical engineers. We have associate electrical engineer postings. Continuous. And this isn't one job. This is multiple jobs for an assistant and an associate. HR had a meeting, because we have meetings with these work groups to hire electricals. It was brought to our attention in October 2018, the associate electrical engineer job that was posted, a little bit over a year, 31 applications were submitted. Out of those 31, four of them reached minimum qualifications. I was here at this same spot in front of you October 8th. And I mentioned management contracted out electrical engineer positions, two to be exact, Honeywell employees. I mentioned management contracted out electrical projects that we always did in-house. We opposed it. We understand the work has to be done. We predicted that the next step with management would contract out electrical discipline for District Force's job. We thought it would take a little bit longer, but a couple of weeks ago, in our contract out committee meeting, we were told for the chemical safety improvement project that was done in-house by electrical forces, by District Forces, mechanical, civil, the electrical portion will be done due to lack of resources. So I'm here in front of you because, as you can see, the problem hasn't gone away. Actually, it's gotten worse. We need an equity adjustment and separate it from negotiations because we need it now. This has been done in the past. The board approved. They saw the staff problem we had for electrical technicians in 2007. The board saw that. And outside negotiations, they made the adjustments. So I think with this problem, the board's assistance and help, we could really address this problem. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Justin. Okay, now we have, I believe, four speakers on the Berryman cell tower issue. And if there's anyone else that is here to make public comment, please fill out a blue card and hand it to our security staff person there, who will give it to the secretary. Speaker number one, Oliver Reisner.
Yeah, hi. Before I start, I'd like to... I sent all of you an email of this last week. I have no idea if you read it, so I would like to enter it, and please read it. It's longer than I can read here.
And I think we could say that most of us, at least I do, read all my emails.
Okay, I'm happy to hear
it. And I hope you read and have seen the...
I'm going to respond to that right now, Andrew Lee's response.
Okay.
So I've read the memo from Andrew Lee in response to concerns members of the public have shared in this room. It focuses on the low-hanging fruit the memo does, on the low-hanging fruit of your structural lease, the importance of making money, the existence of 44 other telecom sites, on the fact you are not required by the FCC to take into account any health issues, etc. It also defines the aesthetic criticisms as mere visual blight. So you are not responsible for anything, and you don't have to do anything. That's wonderful. The memo does not address key points I and others have raised. The known facts of the site show it as being environmentally sensitive and being surrounded by well-documented historical resources. The environmental factors include earthquake fault line, extreme fire risk, creek watershed, and plentiful trees and active steep hillside. The historical resource elements include the Berkeley Landmark site, the Rose Walk, adjacent and rising above the Berryman Reservoir. This landmark includes not only the stairways built in 1913, but also the Green Commons there and the arts and crafts buildings built after the fire of 1923. The views from the publicly accessible lookouts encompass the entire reservoir, not those lame little photos from downstream looking at the proposed site offered by Verizon. Another Berkeley landmark is across the street, the Rose Garden. Registered Berkeley landmark. The Codernices Park itself is an historical resource with its WPA projects and huge community involvement over decades. The creek with its WPA rockwork leading to the Rose Garden itself, the ensemble of pathways, etc. They comprise an invaluable historical resource. The false findings entered by your lessee, Verizon, to the ZAB board state the site is not located in an environmentally sensitive area, and the project will not affect any historical resource. It is on the basis of this claim, the applicant is presented as exempt from CEQA, exempt that is from California laws. EBMUD knows that this is false. Their history at the site, their 1998 EIRs show it. They have been negligent in their duties as utility operator and landlord in this case. If you insist on not hearing, seeing, and speaking here, we would expect further comments from the famous Andrew Lee. The problem of diesel storage and use has not been addressed at all. I continue to urge you to rescind the lease. Thank you.
Thank you. Angelina DeAntonis? Or DeAntonis?
Dear Board, thank you for another opportunity to speak regarding the Verizon lease at Berryman Reservoir, and thank you for your response from Andrew Lee. In his response, you conclude, Verizon is currently not in default of any lease provisions. Therefore, the district has no legal basis to terminate the lease at this time. It appears that the leaser, East Bay MUD, has chosen to ignore our California statute, the CEQA Act. To quote from CEQA's, as defined on Wikipedia, CEQA does not directly regulate land uses, but instead requires state and local agencies within California to follow a protocol of analysis and public disclosure of environmental impacts of proposed projects and to adopt all feasible measures to mitigate those impacts. This is the third time I've come to speak in front of you. I have focused on safety concerns in my previous two statements. And in the response by Andrew Lee, there is no mention of safety concerns. So apparently my voice was not heard, or safety is either of no matter to East Bay MUD, or safety is a strong argument to be ignored. So I'll try a new approach. I'd like to appeal to your conscience. The cell tower will denigrate a historically preserved area. The Codernices Park and Rose Gardens were intentionally designed with a rustic aesthetic and a precedent to keep a wildness in Berkeley. The Rose Walk and the Maybach houses show a vision for a commons infused with nature woven into the surrounding park. Codernices Park is an exemplary model for reclaiming native habitats. There's nothing else quite like this in Berkeley or anywhere surrounding. The WPA era stonework in the park reminds us of an era in American history when there was a vision for creating beautiful public parks. WPA era built campsites, stone bridges, and walkways sit only 100 feet from the proposed site. I brought you photographs of all of these that I mentioned, and I will submit. And from the Rose Walk, adjacent to Berryman Reservoir, the proposed tower would be viewable. There is a City of Berkeley landmark plaque to designate the Rose Walk. And across the street is another City of Berkeley landmark plaque designating the Berkeley Municipal Rose Gardens. I brought copies of those plaques. Let's see. I don't think I have time to read the plaques. I'm going to finish. This project is not like other 44. I urge you to respect California precedent. Please respect CEQA. Please preserve our historic landmarks and preserve our natural spaces. Let's keep some history intact and protected. Thank you.
Thank you. Christian Reisner.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It was good that we got a response. We've been here a couple of times. And we can't go on like this. We have to, there should be some action. I want to respond briefly to a couple of points in the letter that we received, or that came from Andrew Lee. The point here is we've got to deal with CEQA. It can't be ignored. It can't either be gotten around by way of a lease, and it can't be assigned over to a lessee. The law doesn't permit that. Now, the landowner has to see and be observed and observe and take care of lawfully to make sure that illegal activities are not occurring on their land, that they let it out, for example. This is not a new principle. It's nothing unique to CEQA or to California law. It's very ancient. And, of course, we expect that. We all know that principle. If someone does carries out illegal activity on property that they have rented or been given permission to use, the unlawful activity, if the landowner knows of it, that person had better take some steps to bring it to an end. Otherwise, they're going to have some responsibility under the law. And this is just, you know, understood. I am a lawyer. I'm not acting as a lawyer in this case, but as one who lives nearby the proposed project. The CEQA applies to the Berryman Reservoir. It would have been nice if the responsive letter, and it can still happen, dealt with the concept that it doesn't apply. It does apply. There's no exemption that fits here. Actually, none. No exemption has been even cited in the lease, or by Edmund, as far as I know, or by Verizon, except the only place I have seen it is in a preparation of the application that was prepared by the staff at the city zoning board. Of course, the zoning board, you know, rejected the project and said they couldn't make the appropriate findings. They didn't feel comfortable doing that. They didn't feel that they could. I agree with them. And CEQA requires findings. It requires findings as to why it would fit into an exemption if an exemption is claimed. So we have a problem there. CEQA applies, fundamental law applicable to landowners applies. It's not going to go away. And thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you. Lloyd Morga?
Morgan.
You didn't put the N on your card.
Well, I was writing fast. First and most important is I don't believe any of these board members even knew that this had been approved. I know that from coming here the first time, it never came to you. So you are caught in this bind. In addition, no notice was given to the neighborhood. None. Zero. There are children in this park all the time, and they absorb double the radiation to their brain and 10 times to the bone marrow compared to an adult. And there are multiple science studies. I can give you a long list if you would like, that show using radio frequency radiation from cell towers and cell phones creates multiple kinds of cancers, of which brain cancer is the leading one. But there's at least 10 different cancers identified. There's this document from Lee basically talks about a 50-foot tower. Do you know that you're allowed without prior permission to build it higher? Are you aware of that? There's been no survey of the neighborhood. East Bay MUD has never approved the project. That is, the board here has not approved this project. It was approved down the bowels of the organization. The CEQA, you've heard a lot about, it is a major issue, and you must use it. You must apply to it. So that's the end of my discussion. The bell hasn't rung yet, but I pray that you take this into real consideration and you deny this application to Verizon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Morgan. Is there anyone else who's here to speak to this or another issue that's not on the agenda? Alex or Craig, have any?
We don't have anything else to share. We tried to put all of the information in the memo that Andrew Lee had prepared. We subsequently provide a little bit further information that Andrew can make sure we distribute to the community in response to some clarifying questions after one of the members of the community followed up with us. But our current position is as expressed in the memo, and that is that all of the authority to decide whether this cell tower will be approved lies with the City of Berkeley.
Will you stand by the city's decision?
And we will. The city's decision will influence whether Verizon...
Stand by the decision of Berkeley, or will you let them appeal in another superior court against the City of Berkeley?
I'll let you...
What's your position?
So I think, as explained in the Andrew Lee's memo,
he says both.
Well, nothing can occur if Verizon does not get its permit, and Verizon.
The city
can I explain?
Yes.
You've asked a question. I'm trying to explain. So the lease is set up so that Verizon has to go get all permits, and they have to get the CEQA review. When you're putting a cell tower in a neighborhood, there could be people who are for better cell coverage. There could be people who are against having a tower in their in their neighborhood. It is more appropriate for the city, to as the entity that provides the permit, to weigh and determine what's appropriate for the residents in Berkeley. So that's the one reason why we believe Berkeley and the city is the more appropriate agency to address your concerns, but also address any other issues or concerns raised by any other residents. Now, we hear your voice, but it's the...
Sir, Mr. Weissman, you're really out of order. This is public comment. Hang on. It's public comment. This is not on the agenda.
If Berkeley voted down, will you... That.
So Berkeley has the Berkeley. Let me explain. So I'm telling you why Berkeley is the appropriate agency. If Berkeley, the city, if
Mr. Reisner, please, I will ask you to stop.
I don't have to answer your question, but I'm trying to assist you.
Trying to be responsive. Allow him to.
So the city now can weigh and make the decisions, and if the city decides that the tower is not appropriate and it does not issue the permit, Verizon has no ability to build that cell tower on our land per the terms of the lease. And so they would not have gotten the CEQA coverage that is necessary. Now, does Verizon take the City of Berkeley to court? Well, then we just still have to wait and see
how that court...
how that decision turns out, right?
It means Andrew Lee was not being truthful. That's what you just said. He will not respect the decision by the city of Berkeley. He will allow...
Mr. Reiser.
I'm not here to argue with you. I'm just trying to explain.
I think you understand what I'm saying.
Well,
you're
I'm happy to.
Smart. You understand.
I'm happy to have this discussion with you outside the boardroom. But right now, this is all I can say, and trying to be responsive to your question.
Okay. Thank you, Craig. We'll now move on to our consent calendar, and we have 13 items for consideration. I'm guessing. There is one item that our board member Mellon would like to
that is correct.
Move item 13 off consent.
I'll move 1 through 12.
Okay. Well, 1 through 12 have been moved and seconded, and we need a roll call vote due to Director Katz being on the phone.
Ready?
Yes.
Director Coleman?
Yes.
Director Katz?
Yes.
Lenny?
Aye.
McIntosh?
Yes.
Mellon?
Yes.
Patterson?
Yes.
President Young?
Yes. Okay. The consent calendar, actually, let's take item 13, and then following the approval of item 13, those staff members that are here for the consent calendar may go on about their day. Okay.
What's more entertaining, being here, maybe?
maybe. Item 13.
All right. So it's with great pleasure that we are recommending that the board consider appointment of Deborah Michael as Special Assistant 1 in our Office of Governmental Affairs. We've mentioned this before. Additional resource will be greatly appreciated. Ms. Michael comes to us with, near 20 years of experience working on in the legislative policy area, most of it happening in Sacramento. And so we are asking for your consideration and pass it back to you.
I never cease to be amazed that somebody who works for 20 years in Sacramento is still willing to work there. That alone should cause me some suspicion as to whether... But as a mere consent item, no, we can't do that because this is an appointment. And it should be recognized accordingly. So, see, I said it different, guys. So, I'm pleased that you have decided to join us, subject to our vote. And, you know, you sure have done a lot. So, with that, I would move the staff recommendation.
I'll second.
Moved and seconded by Director Lenny. Moved by Director Mellon, seconded by Director Lenny. Roll call, please.
Director Coleman?
Yes.
Katz?
Yes.
Lenny?
Yes.
McIntosh?
Yes.
Mellon?
Yes.
Patterson?
Yes.
President Young?
Yes. Okay. Unanimous. Debbie, it's our tradition to put you on the spot if you'd be willing to do so.
And since she did not go to Stanford, but went to a UC, it's even better.
I'm told there's a pop quiz, too. Just want to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm absolutely thrilled to join your highly respected Sacramento Intergovernmental Affairs team in January. So I've had the good fortune of working with Marlene a number of times in the past couple of years and getting to know the district. I'm impressed. I'm ready to get to work. So thank you. Happy to answer any questions. Otherwise, just appreciate the opportunity.
Great. We'll try to keep you busy.
Oh, we will keep you busy. Have a good holiday and welcome aboard. You bet.
Okay. Those of you that were here for the consent calendar, welcome to leave. This is so that the recording has all this noise of people leaving without showing what's going on. So,
listen to the recording.
Some people do, I hope, out there that you listen. No, I've been informed that there's some unexplained noise following the consent calendar that it'd be good to remark upon.
clearing the room.
Okay, now that we've cleared the room, not completely, there's still a good couple dozen folks in the room. we're on to the general manager's report. Termination discussion. We have a legislative update on what we're going to be doing this coming, what Debbie and Marlene and others are going to be doing.
As Marlene walks up here, we did discuss the items in Ledge Committee and
okay.
All agreed.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
And I'm excited that you've approved the appointment. We're looking forward to getting Debbie on board. Thank you very much. We have our 2020 state legislative initiatives before you. Some of these I'm sure look familiar. Others are perhaps a little newer. If you'd like, I can run through a summary of each one and take questions as we go. Okay, the first one is it's about our ability as a district to act in an emergency. And staff has identified a potential issue in statute that requires a majority of the board to be present within the service area in order to declare an emergency. And we've seen some emergencies that others have experienced in recent years where that may not be feasible. And so what we'd like to do is explore further the feasibility of getting that change in statute to allow board members to call in from outside the service area if for some reason there's an emergency that precludes them from getting back in to the service area. The reason we're not suggesting going right now with legislation is there's a lot of groundwork that we would need to do on this one because it affects every special district. This would be a Brown Act change. So we want to do our homework. We want to see where other stakeholders are. We want to talk to folks in the Capitol. And so we'd like your approval to proceed with that level of outreach to see what the feasibility is of proceeding with legislation.
Is it just special districts or it would also be general purpose?
It would be cities and counties as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pretty big universe.
Marlene, one of the things that we're supposed to do, and I just realized maybe I didn't do this last time I was in San Diego, is we're supposed to let the board president and secretary know that we're going to be out of the area. Would this be part of that legislation that the notification would have had to have been provided so that this teleconferencing process could go forward with some, not legitimacy, but with some appropriateness?
That's a good question. I don't have the answer to that because we haven't gone into exactly what the language would look like for the change. But that's something that we will pay attention to.
I would think that you would want that so as to assure that there was knowledge that the agency member was not in the area so that the contacting isn't just a matter of serendipity.
You know, Frank, with our iPads and iPhones, they know where we are all the time.
I've already suggested I get a naughty note for missing what I was supposed to do. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah, the other thing that I raised related to this item is it's not a legislative item, but this could take a couple of years, is to look at raising the statutory authority that is self-imposed that limits a GM to $350,000 per contract. So during an emergency, if he needs to execute a $5 million contract, he can do it mm-hmm. and rather than being held up. So that, I guess, will go to Finance Committee or something. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll discuss and consider when the best time to bring it back is.
Yeah.
But that amount is a MUD Act amount, right?
Oh, it's not just us. Oh, okay. I thought it was,
but it's self-imposed.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
So that's one.
That's one. All right. Next one is about protecting the McCollumy fishery and water supply reliability. We've written this very broadly. We expect to see conversations that have a nexus to this in several areas. One is we would expect SB1 will come back next year, and you'll recall that we supported that last year, and we'd like to engage again in the coming year. on that effort. Also, if there are any implementing legislation on voluntary agreements, for example, on water quality control plan, on the governor's resiliency portfolio approach, and a collection of other bills, we think there's a lot that has the potential to affect these issues. So this one really is to let you know that we do expect to see a lot coming in this area next year. So we felt that it rose to the level of a separate initiative. The next one is wildfire preparedness, response, and recovery. What we're really talking about here is the public safety power shutoffs and everything that comes with that. Everything from what do we do for the, I think I just disappeared.
No.
Oh, didn't I? Okay. What do we do for the standby power versus what's happening with reimbursement? And what does the legislature intend to do moving forward? When these conversations started a year or so ago, after 901 was passed, there were some members that were really feeling like the shutoffs were here to stay. And now that some have been experienced, we're hearing them saying, well, you know, not so much. Let's look at a way to get these more surgical, and let's look at a way to wean ourselves collectively off of that as an approach to dealing with wildfires. So we have a great story to tell, and we very much intend to stay front and center and sharing our information, our experiences, and moving this forward. Okay, the next one. All right, the next one is, this is time number three on this one. This is Senator Hertzberg's effort to eliminate ocean discharge, and we're hearing that he may want to come back with it again this next year.
Number four.
Yeah, that's number four.
You said three.
Did I skip one?
I thought you said three. I'm sorry.
It's four. Thank you. Yes.
It's okay. Justin created a new local today, so it's okay.
Thank you. All right. So what we're hearing this week is that the focus may be stormwater, not wastewater discharge. But to be fair, that's what we heard last year, and then the bill came back. So if it comes back, we would expect to be heavily engaged. As you know, the unintended consequences are pretty severe for the ratepayer, and we would want to engage very directly and very quickly on that one. Number five is forest health, and we do expect to see some conversations in the Capitol, particularly around the bond discussions. As you know, there are three bonds, or we've talked about before, three active bond measures under discussion in the Capitol that may be down to two fairly quickly, plus the measure that's on the ballot. But the two that are being discussed, there's a real focus on climate resiliency, and there's been a focus on this forest management piece. And this is something that we've been working with UMRA on, but we think there may be opportunity here, so we've included this in the initiatives as well. And number six, this is the low-income assistance. The report from the State Water Board is with the governor at this point. So we do expect to see something on this in the next year. We haven't seen the final report in a public format, so we don't know what's recommended at this point. But we do expect something, if it's not in the budget, policy bills, or both on this issue. So we'd like to be prepared to engage on that one as well. And tied to this is there are most certainly going to be conversations on homelessness, and I understand there's an interest that we engage to the extent possible. So our plan would be to really stay abreast of what's going on in those conversations, look for opportunities for East Bay Mud to engage, to be constructive, and see if there's any way to get water as part of those discussions.
And again, I will move the items. This morning it was a 3-0 vote in support of the six initiatives. As they're written.
So it's six to Marguerite.
Six, I'm sorry.
Here, Marguerite.
This water is really cold. It has to do with the water.
That's a great complaint.
What?
That's a great complaint.
What's in this thermos? so it's six plus then this being engaged in any conversations that come up around the unhoused.
Yeah, I was thinking about it in context of the low-income assistance, kind of putting that one like and a plus.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
That makes sense. Okay. Do we need to vote?
Yeah, yes. We have a first and second on it.
Okay.
Who's roll call?
Yeah.
Director Coleman.
Yes.
Moved it, and Patterson seconded.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. Any other discussion? No. Okay. Roll call.
Director Coleman.
Yes.
Katz.
Yes, I have a couple comments.
Okay. We want to go ahead and take this.
Why don't we go back and take the comments? I think Doug might have had something he wanted. Nope, you didn't. Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead, Director Katz.
Thank you. Yeah, and I would like to thank the staff for the excellent review of some of the most important and pressing priorities that are impacting the district. One comment on the affordability for low-income customers. I like the comment regarding homeless shelters. I think there may be other types of customers who serve the developing population, and looking at the legislative framework that provides for the cap and what types of changes would be needed would be in the interest of the district. So I think looking at that framework to see how could the district benefit from additional discretion so that we're serving the communities that need affordable water would be helpful. While I support the initiatives before us, I would also like to recommend that the staff refer to the Legislative and Human Resources Committee an examination of the Green New Deal legislation that has been introduced by Assemblymember Bonta. It's now a two-year bill. The board has already taken some action on supporting concepts within the National Green New Deal. The legislation, as I understand what Assemblymember Bonta wants to do, is to take a look at what does this transition look like at the state level. And I think the district may play a very important role as a leader in what does workforce development look like for industries that are transitioning. And as we're looking at industries in our community that may have some potential displacement, many of those workers have transferable skills to public water works. So I think that engaging in that conversation, not sponsoring, I believe Assemblymember Bonta is convening a table. So engaging the author's office and seeing how can our perspective be of assistance would be, I think, a productive thing in the next year.
Yeah, I believe APEN is convening that table with Assemblymember Bonta.
So are you asking, Andy, that we embrace Bonta's legislation or take
There's
a look
There's no at legislation. There okay. is a discussion happening about
leading to legislation.
The bill that he introduced a bill last year. It got held. There is a table that's talking about what we might do, but it is okay. way in the conceptual stage okay. at this point from my with my other hat on. My understanding is that the conversation is still kind of up in the clouds. So it's way too early to suggest what we might do. But I think there's if something like a California Green New Deal does move, we certainly want to express our...
Well, I think it would be appropriate to be engaged yeah. and at the table to see how may it be applicable to East Bay MUD.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, we'll certainly check in with Mr. Bonta.
Yes, and likewise, my recommendation is a referral to staff to engage the office and to report back with more information.
Is that a motion, Andy?
No.
No, it's just...
It's just comments.
I believe there's already a motion pending for the six initiatives before us.
Correct. Any other comments with regard to the legislative proposal?
I just think it's a really solid... six initiatives to work from. It's going to be a lot of work.
Yep. Good thing we have another person on board.
Yeah. Debbie's going to be busy.
Yeah.
Jennifer's going to be busy.
Yep.
I'm going to be busy as well. We look forward to it.
Okay, so let's do our vote.
Roll call. Directors Coleman?
Yes.
Katz? Katz?
Aye.
He said
aye.
Okay. Lenny?
Yes.
McIntosh?
Yes.
Mellon?
Yes.
Patterson?
Yes.
President Young?
Yes.
Okay. Another unanimous vote.
Thank you very much. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Yeah, and welcome aboard.
Okay, General Manager's report.
All right, so cool stuff. We, Clifford, and we'll kick off a public safety power shutoff recap.
I don't see our first water report.
You know, I actually had a slide on this one with the, I resurrected moving? Our...
No,
I resurrected our bulldozer to knock down public safety power shutoff, but I thought I'd save that for Dave to use and not reuse his graphic. But anyway, good afternoon. So I, you know, just want to start. I was very, very happy to see the late November rains, not only because it helped our water supply, but it marked an end to this year's public safety power shutoffs. Now, we did come in October and talk about the actual events and the impact. So as the general manager indicated, today is really a retrospective of this year's PSPS events, look at the cost and impact, some of the questions the board had asked, talk about the lessons learned and the next steps. So when you look at the number of PSPS events, so PG&E this year had 8 PSPS events. Of those 8, 4 either affected or could have affected the East Bay and our upcountry facilities. The first one was in on October 9th. That affected 136 facilities, including 2 treatment plants, Arinda and Lafayette water treatment plants, so Arinda being our largest water treatment plant, and 84 distribution pumping plants and reservoirs. The second one, which was the largest, that was on October 26th, that affected 216 of our facilities, including 4 water treatment plants. So that was Arinda, Lafayette, Upper San Leandro, and San Pablo water treatment plants, and a little over 100 of our distribution pumping plants and reservoirs. It also affected upcountry facilities as well. And kind of keep in mind, you know, when you look back, when we met with PG&E earlier this year, and we talked about how many facilities could be affected that were in the Tier 2, Tier 3 areas, they told us a little over 200 facilities. So what that means is the October 26th event, they shut off and de-energized every one of our facilities in the Tier 2 and Tier 3 zones and a few others that we didn't expect to have shut off. Now, there was another event for October 29th that would have affected 23 of our facilities, and another one on November 20th that would have affected 90 of our facilities, but both those were canceled. So at the end of the day, it didn't affect any of our facilities. I'll talk about that a little bit in terms of cost when I get to the slide on cost, because just because they canceled it doesn't mean it didn't cost us anything.
Right.
So we had to take the maps, the outage maps that PG&E provided us, and translate that into... how that would impact our pressure zones. So what you see here on these two maps are the pressure zones that were affected by PG&E's outages. So on October 9th, there were 43 pressure zones that were affected, that affected 97,000 customers, so a little over 30,000 accounts, so about 3 people per home. And then on the October 26th event, that was 73 pressure zones and 236,000 customers. Now, keep in mind that we have 122 pressure zones in our system. So October 9th affected 35% of our pressure zones. October 26th affected 60% of our pressure zones. During the events, we did a lot of communications. We did media advisories, press releases, and we sent tens of thousands of emails via WaterSmart, as well as reaching tens of thousands of people through Nextdoor, just the people who sign up for Nextdoor. Now, keep in mind that we sent those emails and posted the information on Nextdoor only to the affected pressure zones. And the message was pretty simple. We wanted people to minimize their indoor water use and turn off their outdoor irrigation. So what you see here is the effect. And the messages that we sent out, it worked. So this graph shows the days leading up to the first PSPS event, the actual drop in our water demand, and then the recovery. And what you'll see in the table below is we broke that out into the PSPS pressure zones and the non-PSPS pressure zones. And you'll see that there was a significant decrease in water demand in the PSPS pressure zones where we reached out with our communications versus the non-PSPS pressure zones. We saw the same thing for the later October event, a 40% decrease in the PSPS pressure zones versus the non-PSPS pressure zones, which saw a 6% decrease. For those 2 days, water demand decreased by 23 million gallons, and I'll talk about that when I talk about costs as well.
Clifford, before you go on to that, related to the two slides here, had it gone on for a longer period of time, granted we saved 23 million gallons of water, 23 million gallons of water was not used, had it been for an extended period of time, what would that have done to our system and our reservoir since the generators we leased couldn't operate at full capacity? And we had this discussion, you know, whether we should tell everybody to cut back in the event it was long term. You know, we did the second time. We told people to do it, not the first time. I guess I just want to know, looking back in hindsight, if this happens again next year, should we tell everybody to cut back some reasonable amount, even if they're not in the pressure zone, just so that if we need water, need to move water, we have the water available to move and need to fight in a fire if it's local?
Yeah, I don't think that would be necessary. And the reason why is where we had the pumps and the generators deployed, we focused on those areas that we looked at that would be impacted within 1 to 2 days. Now, I think we've talked about, we also have a fleet of additional portable pumps and generators. So we broke out all the various pressure zones and those that would be affected in 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. Had it been a longer outage, we would start deploying the portable pumps and generators to those additional pressure zones to be able to manage it. Now, there is one thing that we would have to consider. If there was a fire that broke out into a particular area, then we would have to react to that. And for the second event, we did see that. Up in Crockett, there was a fire, and we had portable equipment out in that area. And we actually had to ask the fire department to escort us in to refuel those facilities. And there was another fire that broke out into Lafayette.
Yeah, I got evacuated in that one.
Yeah, I think many staff as well got evacuated. So I think we have a pretty solid plan in place, and we're going to refine it going into next year.
Okay, I just want to make sure that you look at what happened in Sonoma and Napa County, where they were offline for so many multiple days. And, you know, again, we had that fire on the 26th of October, Lafayette and then Crockett. Had we had one locally, I guess my concern is I want to make sure that we have adequate water supplies to fight the fires, even if it's not within a shutoff area.
Yeah, and I think what's also interesting, if you look at these two graphs here, you know, the October 10th event was, essentially, it was just a one-day event. Whereas the October 26th, you know, it was actually a 2 to 3 day event. But you look at that drop in the water demand, you see the drop, and it came almost entirely back. We sent the message out just one time. My guess is, had we sent it out multiple days, that demand would have stayed down. And, you know, people are talking about, well, their power is out, so their irrigation system went out. Well, what this shows you is, in the second event, it dropped, and then the next day it came back, so... The event and the response, our staff needed some additional equipment that they didn't have in parts, and that was around $38,000. During the second event, we did shut down Lafayette and San Pablo rec areas, and that lost revenue was around $19,000. Upcountry, there was also some lost revenue and product. The store had to throw away some dairy products and meat. That was around $4,000. And that 23 million gallons that we had our customers conserve, that cost about $173,000. So in total, when you look at all the PSPS events, that was about $1.5 million. Now, I was talking about the events that they canceled, and I'll just speak to the November 20th event, only because that was a very distinct event from the second event where it kind of rolled, one event rolled into the other. But they notified us of the event. We had to start sending field staff out there to start connecting up generators because we didn't know if they would cancel the event. And so when we looked at labor, that was about $25,000 of labor just getting ready for the event that they canceled. Now, when you look in terms of the hours, for regular labor hours, that was around 7,100 hours, and the overtime hours was about 965 hours. The overtime hours, pretty much all 965 hours, was the field response. There was a few overtime hours for the preparation work. So there was a lot of effort that went into responding to this particular event. When you look at the recreation areas, we broke this into the visitors that were denied access, and you can see the breakdown between San Pablo and Lafayette recreation areas, as well as the upcountry facilities. And then up at Comanche North and the South Shore, there were a number of people who had to get evacuated.
Were those the campers, or were the people in the mobile homes?
It was the campers as well as the RVs. Okay, so both.
And was there a fire up there?
You know, I don't know exactly why they were evacuated, but that was the information that I got.
The power was down up there.
Yeah, but
there was no fire, to my knowledge.
Yeah, no fire that I was aware of.
Yeah, but people don't evacuate.
So we have, I'm not sure what the term evacuate, why we use that term, but we have, as you know, for example, at the party recreation area, we have these spaces that we've created where RVs come in for the entire season.
Right.
So we ask them all to leave because of the potential fire threat. That is an example of an evacuation.
Okay.
I guess you could call it an evacuation or, hey, you need to leave.
Right. Closing the recreation area, everybody has to go. Okay.
The other question that was asked by the board was, what was kind of that opportunity cost? What didn't we get done? And so because a lot of the work was related to the field activities, we really focused on what field work didn't get done. And when we boiled down to, it was just delayed work at our water treatment plants, the pumping plants, the reservoirs, and the regulators. And we looked at our backlog, and so for October, we saw our backlog increase by about 80 work orders. Now, we're evaluating which ones we're going to do and which ones we're just going to, you know, catch up on the next time around. But we've worked for a number of these work orders, about $50,000 of overtime to date, just to catch up on some of the work that didn't get done in October. And so we haven't completely quantified the total cost that would represent for just catching up the work that didn't get done.
Is that 80 work orders in comparison to how many?
In comparison to the total number, I don't know how many work orders there are, but there are hundreds of work orders that come in every month.
So this is like 20% more. To me, that number doesn't have, sounds like a lot to me, but maybe it's not as many as, I mean, it's a lot of overtime.
It is a noticeable increase in the work orders. So when you look at the graph, it's not flat and a little blip. I mean, it's a pretty significant increase. I couldn't tell you exactly how many work orders they have in any particular month. But, you know, if you look at the number of work orders, you know, some of them are corrective work we have to do. Some of them are preventative work. So think of it like an oil change. You just say, well, you know, I'm just going to defer it and we'll skip one.
Right.
But there's a lot of work that has to get done, which is why you see some of that overtime work that's happening. So how did we do? We did really well. We had no customer impacts, no pressure or impacts or level of service impacts. We had a very positive customer response. Most importantly, our employees were safe. We sent out a lot of safety messages to our staff because they're working at night. There's no lights. There's no signal lights, high winds. So we wanted to make sure our staff were safe. And we also have a lot of new employees that haven't gone through an emergency, and so they gained a lot of EOT experience, which was really good. What were the keys to our success? Preparation, number one. We did a lot of preparation, developing our mitigation plans, exercising, just thinking through how we would respond. We did a lot of coordination with PG&E as well as our various cities as well. We pre-deployed the equipment. There is no way on earth we could have deployed 30 to 35 pieces of equipment in 1 to 2 days. And that pre-deployment really made a big difference.
Does that mean that while you couldn't know exactly where it's going to be at, you use central points so that you could get the equipment to a spot quicker?
No, we actually had the equipment at the locations. When we were preparing for the event, when we were meeting with PG&E, they were telling us, well, we might shut down 1 or 2 circuits, but they couldn't tell us which ones, understandably. And because they couldn't tell us, we said, you know what, let's not try to guess. We'll just deploy it at all these locations, you know, that would affect, you know, that would be affected in 1 to 2 days. it was very fortunate we did that because even though PG&E told us they would do one or two circuits, in fact, they shut down everything. And so that was, as we were going into this season, we didn't know exactly how this would work on the East Bay. So this was all part of kind of our lessons learned of how would PG&E actually implement a PSPS event. Another key to success, we pre-prepared all of our messages to our employees, to elected officials, to the customers, the social media, the news media. We weren't scrambling to put together the content. We developed all that message beforehand. We also developed a website beforehand and the maps, and we tested out the maps to make sure that would work. And then we met with the community ahead of time to let them know what we were doing so they felt comfortable that we were prepared. And, of course, our employees. There is no way this could have been done without our employees, both in the emergency operations team and all of the field staff. They came through and did an excellent job and really made East Bay Mud look good in this PSPS response. So we hear a lot about a PSPS event lasting 1 to 3 days. And what we learned from this event was that a 1 to 3 day outage actually has a much greater impact on East Bay Mud. And I just want to walk you through a generic timeline. This is based on our experience now. But they give us 48 hours notice of a PSPS event. Our field crews have to mobilize, connect equipment, set things up, test the equipment. The actual de-energization is about 4 hours, but that's when we cut over power from PG&E to our backup power. During the PSPS event, which can last 1 to 3 days, we're out there checking on the equipment, refueling equipment, making sure everything's working. When they re-energize, we're still checking on equipment, refueling, because they're not cutting over everything at one time, and that takes time. And finally, the demobilization. When we're done, we gotta bring back the equipment that hasn't been pre-deployed. We gotta take all the cables that connected all the generators to our facilities. We gotta store those. So a 1 to 3 day event is actually 5 to 9 days for us in terms of response, which explains why it's so expensive to respond to a PSPS event. So as far as next steps, we did prepare an op-ed with some other Bay Area water agencies to thank our customers on their response to PSPS. We are going to incorporate lessons learned from this year into next year's plan. We do plan to meet with PG&E and talk to them about what worked and what didn't work. So in particular, they could always improve on their communications. We didn't hear about the late October and November 20th, the cancellation. I think the November 20th event, we only heard about it on the radio, which is not the way we want to hear about it. And then there was the large treatment plants. We're hoping that they can do a little more segmentation so that they don't take our treatment plants out. I mean, we can manage, but it's preferably we don't have to shut down or have our treatment plants on backup power. We do have to prepare a backup generator rental contract for 2020, and then we're continuing to participate in the CPUC process. And with that, I can take any questions.
Okay. I think I've got a bunch, so let's start at the end and work our way over. Director Patterson?
I think I expressed both my concerns and my congratulations to you and staff for the fine job you did related to our emergency preparedness and our involvement as a team member during the whole operations. One of the things that I pride myself on is the thorough preparation that you exhibit in all you do, and the staff is to be complimented for that, because we were more effective than any other entity during the emergency. I think PG&E was flying by the seat of his pants. And this is what we learned over time, because we have had a broad network of experiences. Operations are not confined to one location. They spread from here all the way up to Calaveras County and more. And so all those things considered, our first walkthrough two or three years ago We learn every time, and we build on every experience. It costs us a little, but that's all right. That's what we're here for. And so my words are simply that you do your job in an exceptional manner.
Thank you. I do just want to quickly add, though, it was staff from every department at East Bay MUD that supported this event. It was not just an O&M effort. Every department had major contributions for the success.
Let me start off by saying I couldn't be more proud to be on this board for the work that the staff did. Every single one of them, extraordinary. Thank you. Correct me if I'm wrong, though. We didn't budget for this, did we?
We did not.
So this is $1.4 million expense that we have had to come up with above and beyond what we had as budget. We need to tell that story. And I'm certainly willing to be one of the letters to the editor type to tell the story. Thank you for the exceptional work.
Frank, let me just inject to what you said, because I sit on the Finance Committee. I just want to just say we are prepared in our budget for emergency. So we have an emergency contingency fund. And this gave us an opportunity to deal with how well prepared we were budget-wise from a fiscal standpoint. I want to make that point because we didn't have to go hunt for money or ask anybody for anything.
Thank you.
It's built in.
I appreciate that. Thanks for the clarification.
Thank you, Alex.
Anything else? Doug?
I want to add my congratulations as well to everyone, given especially the comments I was hearing from other public agencies that were really struggling and didn't have quite as good a turnout as we did, our outcome. I was just curious on the issue of the generator rental. Is there a shortage? I think some of the other folks I talked to just had a hard time tracking down getting generators that were at the ready. Were we ahead of others in line somehow, or how did that play out?
Yeah, we were well ahead of the curve there and got our proposal out and the generators in. I suspect for next year that the companies will be better prepared and have more of an inventory in California to supply, but we certainly heard the same thing, that there were certain companies and entities and utilities that had difficulty. I think at the end of the day, they all got it, but it just took a while for the rental companies to get their act together and realize that there was really going to be a market for the generators. But we did get in very early.
Thank you.
The only question I'm looking forward to how we're going to address it in 2020 and going forward. And I need to really thank Clifford, Alex, and Kelly. I probably asked a lot of pointed, hard questions during the process. I think you guys did a hell of a job. The entire staff did. Thank you very much.
You're here.
Yeah, ditto. I agree. You guys did a wonderful job. And to piggyback on that, to prepare for 2020, we really don't know until we know if this is going to be our norm, their norm, PG&E's norm, and if it's something that we'll always have to respond to. Because when we talk about generator rentals, I would imagine that if this is going to be an ongoing thing, these shutoffs, that ultimately we may have to purchase our own and store them. But that all goes into 2020 when we start rethinking and reimagining this process. But great job this year.
Yeah, and we'll be thoughtful about what we buy and what we rent and inform the board.
And is there, I mean, I would add my kudos to those of everyone else. I mean, it was, I think it was the one on the 26th when, basically everybody was affected and there was no good information out there except ours.
Yeah.
Just the number of people that, sort of gave East Bay MUD the pat on the back and at least somebody knows what the hell they're doing. Kind of comments that I'm sure all of us got
as others were talking about, oh, gee, I guess the Kelvin Cop Tunnel won't have any lights on, you know, things like that. That, you know, and the, one of the things that I said is like, well, we started preparing for this nearly a year before it happened. As soon as it got announced that this was going to be something that would happen, we started planning for it. And I don't think that could be said for, I don't know. I don't know if that's true for every, if everybody else spent that amount of time. I know Sonoma County Fire has been, you know, sort of the fire preparation kind of cycle is was happening. But I think for most other places, I don't think anybody really had sort of a consciousness about what it was going to mean in the real world for their mission. And whether that's you know, somebody providing care to folks that are stuck in their houses or medically dependent or anything else. I mean, I just think it didn't get thought through and were the, you know, sort of shining exception. So I just, you know, hats off to everybody on that. The one question I have, and it goes to the sort of generator or how are we prepared, and I guess it, you know, strikes me that, you know, PSPS is just sort of a rehearsal for an earthquake or for the big one when our, you know, facilities are stuck without power and our ability to serve our customers is, you know, sort of severely hampered. I'm wondering whether we're looking at how many of our facilities might be able to be, off the grid, basically, or be able to switch over to off the grid either you know, at some lower level over a longer period of time through, you know, solar or and bat plus bat some battery on site battery storage or, you know, other means. And I don't know if we've thought about that so much and or whether it even, you know, work or be applicable for more than a few hours.
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, we've been starting looking at PSPS since July of 2018. And even before then, we were looking at our pumping facilities and all of our facilities and trying to figure out what's the right size of portable pumps and portable generators and what are critical facilities. So I think exactly to your point, we're looking at, you know, how many more should we buy, how many more should we just, you know, rent, and as far as the generators and portable pumps. So I think we're well positioned. You're exactly right. We've talked about this during the event. This is like the earthquake without the earthquake. And so I think kind of going into next year, one of the things we're going to be looking at is our earthquake response plans and incorporate lessons learned from the PSPS into that as well. So your point's well taken.
Yeah, I mean, I do some work with some of the water agencies. It's amazing. Literally, some of them shut down operations entirely trying to deal with the PSPS during their thing. There was nobody there. And whereas we were out there doing the thing, and again, huge kudos to everybody who was involved. I heard no complaints at all.
Ditto.
Yeah, especially staff who were dealing with power shutoffs in their own residences, right? Okay, thank you.
Madam President, I just wanted to have a concluding remark. I remember all of the work that we did upcountry in helping that situation, actually preventing some things from happening, and our experiences there. We have had ongoing experience with emergencies. We did a better job of handling those and then providing that information as a backup going forward. So our chest of drawers in which we have plans and all kind of things for capital improvement also have emergency services vented in it. And that's what we built on. So we have a record of performance under heavy fire, so to speak. And East Bay Mud is built on that. That happened when we had the last earthquake. We finished first of all the agencies in the East Bay in our seismic improvement program. So we've demonstrated these things and built it in. That's what makes the organization strong, and that's what keeps us in the leadership position. I just wanted to put that in for the record.
Okay, thank you.
got a couple of other items in the GM report. Right, but no snow report yet, huh?
No, yeah.
Next meeting, okay.
What? We
typically start in...
So the summary is we're slightly above average.
Come on, man,
David. And working on the graphics.
At the last meeting, I said I really looked forward to the next meeting getting it. It better be more than a snowplow next time.
By your bar on the graphics there, Dave.
Pressure's on.
All right. We have a great graphics department. Just, you know, get them on, get them enlisted.
So also in your materials, there's the six-month forecast of committee assignments, and I would just summarize that and board workshop efforts, and that we will have roughly one workshop a month on top of the regular baseline board meetings and committee meetings in the first half. We're building on the infrastructure workshop so that we can get to a place where we'll ask the board to consider a strategic plan update. And so that'll happen at the end of the fiscal year. There's a monthly report, and at your places, you also have the outreach activities, which of course is a little thinner here in the holiday season. And I can work to answer any questions, and I wish you all a happy holiday.
Thank you. Thank I you. Do have a question, Madam President.
Yes.
Alex, on the 2020 board committees and workshops, so I see for January the West County Wastewater District Agreement, and you mentioned to me this morning that we were going to, Marguerite, I and you, staff, were going to meet with them.
Right.
Prior to or after?
I think that it will probably end up being after, but okay. we'll let them know. I just want to be able to get, Eileen wanted to be able to get back to them. Okay. The agreement is, there should be no contest on it. It's a good agreement.
Okay. All right. And last, on Ledge HR agenda, so I see the second Tuesday Diversity and Inclusion Program quarterly update. And then I see on the, hang on.
Which month are you on, Lisa?
I'm looking at Ledge HR January.
And then March again, right?
And then March again. But I'm also seeing in February the effects of affirmative action program on diversity numbers. It just seems to me that we could sort of consolidate some of those things.
Well, why don't we take a look at that?
Okay.
You know, they're discrete, but maybe we can find an opportunity to merge them.
All right. I would appreciate that. Thank you, Alex.
I'd like Kelly and company, great job on getting out all the wonderful news on the McCollum River salmon. We've got a lot of great press and PR, and that only helps our efforts upcountry and statewide, especially the voluntary agreement discussion. So thank you.
And thank the fish.
And the fish, too, yeah. Into the wrong turn.
Okay. We have short, brief reports from the planning committee. Doug?
Yes, the planning committee met this morning, and we discussed got an update on the Senate Bill 998. That is the bill that legislature passed in order to help low-income customers or to deal with notices for shutoffs, in water districts. And nice to hear the report that East Bay Mud is well ahead of much of the legislation. Only one small update that we'll be getting to our policy. But otherwise, we've already implemented 99% of what the legislature, the Senate Bill 998, was recommending or is requiring now. And the second item was facility landscape maintenance, which has to deal with staffing the peak loads of dealing with summer fire loads in our district.
And then Ledge HR?
Yeah, we met this morning. All three board members were there. Our first item was item 14 today on the legislative report, the six initiatives. We supported it. And the second item was what was item 6 on our agenda, the deferred the compensation plan record. We supported that, and it's already dealt with by the board.
Okay. All right. Great. Where did my agenda go? There it is. I think if you have items for future consideration, please submit them to the general manager. This is our last. Do we have any other director comments other than
Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays.
Happy Holidays.
Happy Holidays.
For everybody. Happy end of the decade. Mm-hmm. We'll convene next in the roaring 20s of this century. Hopefully not to repeat it as the roaring 20s of the last century. Yeah.
That could have been fun, though.
Yeah.
Not the end.
Oh, not the end.
Not the end. And the beginning was led to the end, so we don't want to go there. All right. Thank you, everyone. It's been a pleasure to serve you this year, and look forward to next year. We are adjourned.
Yeah.